This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and top leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
And welcome once again to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. And we have a lot of heavy thoughts coming our way today. I can tell the group is warmed up. We have a variety of people involved, kind of all involved in generating more economy in the Twin Cities by developing people, developing businesses, and finding people. We have Major, well, it's almost redundant, Major King. Which is the higher rank, Major or King?
Oh, it's good to be the King.
It's good to be the King. We have, more specifically, Louis King II. Yeah. I mean, it's even like a royal lineage.
Julius King II.
Oh, really?
Julius Caesar.
Wow. And he's the president and CEO of Summit Academy, OIC, right?
Right.
And that stands for Opportunity Industrial Workshop?
Industrialization Centers.
Industrialization Centers, okay.
Founded by Leon Sullivan, 1967. I'm in Philadelphia. Tasty cakes, black folks was eating them all. We couldn't eat in the bakery. We couldn't drive the truck, work in the store. So they boycotted him. And they said, well, what do you want? Jobs. Well, what can you do? Nothing. So he took a dollar, bought an old jail, started OICs, and here we are today.
Bought an old jail?
Oh, an old jailhouse. Yeah, abandoned, you know, old one. It was sitting there, right? And they converted it. At the heyday, you had 150 of them around the country. Today, we have about 43. We have three here in Minnesota.
So, yeah, I'm familiar with the American Indian IOC.
Great.
So that's over in Franklin and Cedar and thereabouts.
Right.
So, and we also have with us Casey Allen, who kind of everybody knows him, so he doesn't need a business name. That's Casey Allen. But he's was a serial entrepreneur and a serial investor and also an advisor, kind of in the realm of technology, startups. Is that correct? How did you get into that? Did you have to stay in your room all day and then invent a computer?
I got into it by an entire lifetime of doing my own startups, being founder of my own startups.
No, a lifetime beginning?
Beginning at 18.
Okay.
And
What was your first job?
Making that like a paying job?
Yeah. Like, do you deliver newspapers or something?
When I was 15, I mean, I worked at Subway. Making sub sandwiches.
How you got started.
Yeah.
So that's low technology, but still
incredibly low technology.
But still it's technology. You had sharp knives and everything.
This is true. And I made the journey much harder on myself than I needed to, because all through my 20s, I was incredibly bad at surrounding myself with other successful entrepreneurs and finding mentors and advisors that could really kick me in the ass when I needed it. And as a result, it was an incredibly lonely journey. Much lonelier than it had to be. So now in my 30s, I'm wake up every single morning thinking about how do I make it a less lonely journey for other entrepreneurs? And if I can make that just a little bit easier and surround them with the right kind of people that can help them get to the next level, then my job in life is done.
So call 1-800-LONELY-CASEY.
I don't pretend to have all the answers, but if there's one perhaps redeeming skill that I hope to hone in life, is the ability to bring together amazing people all into one place, all at the right time, in the right way to help the right person overcome whatever challenge they have.
So kind of like this podcast.
Sure. I mean, you act as the glue to bring together the right concoction.
Right.
And that's what I spend most of my life doing is cat herding, but doing it in a way where it's all focused on just technology, just early stage startups, and for the most part, just Minnesota or the Midwest, which is my focus area, just so I don't wake up every morning trying to boil the ocean, I can actually have something to focus on.
Great. And here we are in the Midwest. So I guess we've got a lot of bases covered. And we have Paul DeBettings from Minnesota Headhunter. And of course, that goes without explanation.
When I I started writing a blog in like 2005, and I didn't know what to call it. And I realized that no one could spell or pronounce DeBettings.
No, I can't.
And then I'm like, well, let's just call it what I am. And then a number of years later, then I was talking to my business attorney, and I was looking to start sort of a new entity. And I said, like, can I incorporate Minnesota Headhunter? And she's like, yeah, why can't you? I'm like, I don't know. Like, it just seemed weird. And she's like, why don't you incorporate what you are? I'm like, oh.
So nobody's done it yet. You were the first one.
Apparently so. Still the one.
Good. Well, now you focus on technology.
Mostly when Casey's talking about startups, early stage groups, I'm helping the ones who are growing and hiring. And so I help companies source, recruit, hire, help with the recruiting process and strategy. Hmm. And then a lot of times be an advocate or an evangelist for them in the community, because generally speaking, they're not always well known or yet not have been heard of.
Hmm.
And then you can do the same side on the Fortune 500 companies too. Like, there will be groups that will, people will be like, oh, that's an old company and they don't do a lot of cool stuff. But you say, but hey, they're creating a new BI data intelligence group. And so here's what they're doing. And this is really cool. And people go, oh, so I might want to go work there.
Hmm.
So it's I sometimes will consider myself more of a storyteller. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, source and recruit and hire, but like, let's tell the employer stories. Here's why it's cool to go work for these companies. Because a lot of times there's just a lot of noise out there.
Well, you must be the kind of person, you must have lots of friends. They say, hey, Paul, can you get me a job?
I like to suggest that I have like the widest, shallowest network around. So it's a lot of people, not very well, because people will come to me. Some of my friends, Casey not being one, Casey is a friend of mine.
Okay, let's get it all out.
But my like non-tech friends only come to me for advice about every 3 to 5 years when either they're looking for a new role or they got downsized.
Oh.
And then they go, oh, this is why we keep you around. Because you've got this really cool advice that then they don't need for another 3 years.
Paul, the headhunter guy.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we have a formula here. We have enough people. I mean, what you do... Well, I don't know if I'd call you Major or Lewis.
Yeah.
I mean, so, because I was raised in the military. My father was in the Marine Corps.
Huh?
So until I was 13, I didn't get discharged till I was 13.
Oh, wow.
So then I've been
in. You get it.
Yeah, I get it. But the civilian, I've never really fully adapted to the civilian world.
You never do.
You never do?
No.
Now, do you take some of the well, I was just going to connect the two of you, but do you take some of the military discipline that you learned to treat your students? What you do is you train.
Put your emotions aside is the first thing.
Okay.
We're too emotionally driven. Our interests, whether you decide to drop out of school, whether you're trying to be cool doing something, versus do the task in front of you. Have the discipline to do, make your bed when you get out of it. You got to learn that. If you don't learn it, behavior is learned. And so in my entire career, I went to an all-boys college. I was a soldier for 10 years. I understand guys. I mean, it's their what motivates them.
And you've seen them in their natural habitat.
Absolutely. And they want to form groups. They want to form norms. Somebody's got to set a standard and say, hey, look, this is it. There's no negotiating. You're in or you're out. And most people want to rise to the challenge.
And so you give them that challenge and you structure it.
Absolutely. And you let them know that you care about them. And at 3 a.m., they get fed before I do. I get fed last.
Hmm.
Because they had to crawl under that vehicle on the ice to fix it. And I'm standing there watching the operation.
With your hands in the pocket.
Roger that. Well, never. That's Air Force.
Oh. But, I knew it was one of those uniformed military groups.
We don't do it like that. But they got to know that you care for them. And if you care about them, they will go to the end of the earth and become heroes and surprise people. We fight for each other, not the flag. We fight for the guy next to you.
Hmm.
All right? First and foremost, you never screw your buddy. Because when your back's turned, you ain't got it.
Right. Right.
And as commanding officer, your back is always turned because you're out front.
Hmm. So you got to trust. You got to make sure that you trust them and they trust you.
They trust you first. If you're not going to get them into anything you can't get them out of. And when you get them into something, they're ready to go. They're ready to play ball.
Hmm.
Everybody's coming on.
So how does this apply to your work at the OIC?
So when I came into this neighborhood, I'm 58 now. At age of 29.
You're older than Casey.
Yeah, a little bit. And didn't know what a nonprofit was. And in the military, you have 100% employment, 100% housing, 100% healthcare and discipline. So I was just intrigued by the fact you had these little black boys running around with their hats turned sideways and just acting a fool in the neighborhood. And I was, what's up? Well, they're not working. Well, why not? Apartheid. Well, what's up with that? Education, social networks. Oh, we'll fix that. And so I got into it, and I discovered there's more to it than meets the eye. But we built a strong point at Summit. We run 1,000 people through a year, about $8 million. Nobody pays a nickel out of their pocket. I can take them from $11,000, $35,000 in 20 weeks, and now the word is out. So people know it's a tradition. And the first industry that we penetrated was construction because the demographic shift was coming, and you had these affirmative action goals that they said they couldn't find any. I said, I got a whole crew over here. I said, oh, we didn't mean it like that.
And then I go, we didn't really look.
But I did. Okay.
Yep.
I'm your huckleberry, right? You want to get out? I'll take two busloads over to the legislature, show up at Hennepin County. We'll shut down your job site. We'll put you on the World Wide Web. So when you're trying to get a job in Denver, people go, whoa, what's the problem in Minneapolis? And since your daddy's name is on the company, you're going to sit down at the table with me. You're going to play ball. And I'll send you good people. Because you put your money on the table and your daddy mortgaged his house. I get it. All right, let's play. So we did Twins, TCF. We really, really hit prime time on U.S. Bank. But all that's done now. And so, you know, having soldiered my way through Europe, I'm Alexander the Great, looking for the next horizon.
What's the next battle? What's the next?
IT.
IT. What a coincidence.
Still, yeah, right.
We're
young. Daddy's haven't owned the company for 100 years. It reinvents itself every nanosecond.
Well, have you met Paul DeBettings, the headhunter, Minnesota headhunter?
Oh, man, he's about to have a new best friend.
we're gonna have a long conversation.
And this is not going to be a thin friendship.
No, this one's going to go deep.
It's a new world. I mean, we never anticipated, you know, the boomers came home from World War II and boom, right? When you look at the age of the veterans now from World War II, they have eclipsed. The Korean guys are 90 now, all right?
All right.
So here we go. The guy born in 60, me, is the baby of the boomer class, all right? Born in 1960. So the supply is kind of this upside down deal. You got a big class coming with the millennials, but in the short run, the next 20 years or so, we got a problem, and it's structural.
The boomers are retiring.
Well, retiring, dying, moving away, I mean.
Or dying.
Or they're at least downsizing their careers. Like they are not doing what they have been doing for 40 or 50 hours a week for 40
years.
Ready to
do something different.
Yep.
Yeah. So we have a structural problem then because none of the social networks work anymore. And in the emerging populations, people of color, black folks, immigrants, who saw Ilhan Omar coming, for example? Mm-hmm. I mean, take that as a sign of things.
Mm-hmm.
Just put that on the wall and say, all right, let's prepare for a future that is wrapped around Ilhan and everybody she represents. And we don't have, right now, the relationships, sometimes the will to develop that strategy. And whoever does it first will win.
Hmm. So what I've been hearing, I mean, I've been involved in business journalism for a long time, and the thing that I've heard for a long time is, one, the biggest challenge is always employees, and now the biggest challenge is finding skilled employees. And so, but at the same time, the Twin Cities, we have this, it's the big schizophrenic city. Not only in that it has two capitals, Minneapolis and St. Paul, but that it's rated number one on everything, except when you get to race, then it's like number one the other way around, the biggest academic achievement gap, the biggest income gap, housing gap, and all those things. It's crazy. And you're here.
So here's the deal. The first problem here is that it was overwhelmingly white. When I got here, I go, wow. So this is where white people go when they die and go. Right? Everybody goes to heaven or hell. This is it. I never seen.
Let's go to Minnesota.
I came here from Europe and grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, and went to Morehouse College in Atlanta. And then I came here and was like, okay, I get it. You don't have an indigenous African American community, middle class African American community here. There's no such thing as a black middle class neighborhood in Minneapolis, right there. So you don't have the entrepreneur class to emerge. You don't grow the talent. Most of the middle class African American talent comes here working for the Fortune 5s. They're implants. They live outside the perimeter. Their only connection to the community is church. They don't even know where Broadway or Plymouth Avenue are. So we have right there structural. Then the schools, right? If all the people are poor and they're always off balance, here's what follows. I was a school board member. Did one term, declared defeat, and left. So those two things.
A soldier was defeated?
You got to know when to pop smoke and unask the AO, all right? You got to know when to go do something different. And there are 18 neighborhoods in Minneapolis that have double-digit unemployment. They're dominated by people of color. They have high school diploma or less, and they're renters. So the segregation, the housing patterns, and if you don't make any money, you can only live in certain places.
So it goes back to the original redlining.
Ta-da. All right. So how do you fight your way out of this box? Well, Mother Nature delivers a nice gift to you with the demographic shift. All right. That's a gift. Nobody can stop it. Demand the marketplace. It was silly for the city councils to debate the minimum wage. That was all politics. You can't pay anybody the minimum wage and get them to come work for you these days. That dog don't hunt. So the marketplace is taking steps. But the force that is emerging has three issues. One, they're not educated. 35% of the black kids drop out. We can fix that. Put a GED program in place, attach it to skills training, give it a purpose.
And that's part of Summit.
Bingo. In 30 weeks, I can take you from zero to 35,000. Ta-da. Two, if they don't have education, they don't have skill, what would we trade in the marketplace? These guys have things that people buy. They don't do widgets. They do other things. You do other things. I lead, right? People will buy that. So what's your skill? Pick it out. Go do it. It needs to be a passion or just be a job. And then third, and this is the most important one. People always delude themselves. I was glad Mr. Allen said it. The Lone Ranger, that's a lie. Even he had a partner. Right? you know what I mean? You didn't do it by yourself. All that bootstrap BS, come on. You know, we need our social networks. Social networks are very powerful. If you're poor, they tell you where to go get drugs or where to go get the hookup from welfare or, you know, where the free stuff is. If you're rich, it's where to vacation, where to invest. Your networks function with the unions. How to get into a union. All those boys aren't geniuses, but it's the network. And that is now the weakness of what had been the dominating class, the white male, and that they don't, it's like going to Oklahoma to fish. I'm from Florida, right? You go to the ocean, you can see the ocean, water everywhere. In Oklahoma, you can't see the farmer's pond. You don't know it's there.
I didn't even know you could fish in Oklahoma.
Bingo.
Is it legal?
You got it, right? You can't see his pond, and you can't get on his property. But if you know him, you can get in the gate, drive past the cows. The pond is on the other side of the hill, and there's some big catfish and crappie and bass in that pond.
So if you want to go fishing, I know a guy. Like that.
That's it.
So the more networking, the better. Do you have classes for your students in how to network?
Actually, we're the bridge. We believe in rifle shots. So
rifle shots?
Yeah, not shotgun blasts. You don't just throw people against the wall and hope they stick. You have to have intimate relationships. Because I can't send my people over to you and you grind them up, right? All of them bad? For real, dude? I tell you what, I'm not sending you anybody else. I'm sending them to your competition so they can run your ass out of business. All right? I'm not playing with you. So
everything, you have lots of strategies and tactics.
If you play to win, you can either show up and get played, or you better think about the game beforehand and then have everything, the order of battle better be laid out.
Boy, I want to be on your side.
Always.
We're here talking with the... so many titles. President, CEO, Major Louis King II, who runs Summit Academy, OIC.
Right.
I forgot which one. EIEIO, you know, one of those things. And we're with Casey Allen. We'll have to get to you sometime, Casey. You're so reticent over there. We'll have to open you up a little bit. And we're here with Paul DeBettings, of the Minnesota Headhunter, of course. We'll be back right after this with Synapse Think Tank of the Year.
Synapse Think Tank of the Year. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back. Steve LeBeau here, Synapse Think Tank of the Air. And, the ideas are flowing so fast, it's kind of hard to gather them all. We're here with Summit Academy President and CEO, Lewis King II, and Casey Allen, an investor, serial entrepreneur, et cetera, advisor, networker. And he's pretty old now. You're pushing 40.
Soon to be dad.
Soon to be dad. That's right. Now, then you'll get old. Well, then, you'll get old, but then you'll get young because you have to have the mentality to deal with the toddler.
Note, he doesn't have any gray hair yet.
No gray hair. Okay, well, do one of those photo deals. And Paul DeBettings, the Minnesota headhunter. And talking here about getting people into the economy, the labor shortage. I talked to some young entrepreneurs, maybe you've heard this story, they graduated from college in 2008 and go, crap, there's no jobs, everything's dying, and so they had no option but to become entrepreneurs. And if you look at the scheme of things, the small businesses with 1 to 10 people, they employ most of the people in the world, right? Casey, I'm looking at you now. Is that right?
For sure. When you take a look at, if you want to get, I guess, academic about startups and what that means for the economy. Out of 100 startups, 91 will fail, right? 8 or 9 will do okay. But then there's always that 1 out of 100 that will blow up. I mean, Jamf Software, for example, Jamf Software is downtown Minneapolis, 800 employees now. It wasn't that long ago, a decade ago, it was only 3 of them, right? So you take a look at Fortune 500s, for example, Ameriprise maybe, or General Mills, and the net gain, which is what really matters. It doesn't matter how many people they hired this year. It matters net gain.
Because they laid off 1,000 last year.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Or just through natural attrition, people have left to go on to what they think is greener pastures. So startups are just interesting in that it's almost always a net gain. But I'm interested in specifically the few that really break out.
That sounds like a slogan for hiring Marines.
There we go.
A few good entrepreneurs.
Find the outliers. When I invest and when I allocate my time and energy into startups, if you're a sports fanatic, for example, what I'm talking about is slugging percentage, not batting average. Batting average in the case of companies that become huge or become big deals, you are talking about slugging percentage here, right? You're talking about a few percentage points. If you're looking at a bell curve, I'm not talking about the middle. That's not very interesting to me. I'm talking about the long, skinny tail at the very right side of the bell curve. And there you get startups that, again, very, very few can cross the chasm. But when you do, then it becomes a very big deal. This isn't also, by the way, just because I'm a startup guy, I'm not talking about just startups. I'm talking about nonprofits. I'm talking about any entity that's created from scratch.
Restaurants.
Restaurants, sure. There's like at Surly Brewing. So there's always a few that really break out and become very big deals. And these are the ones that move the needle.
And the ones that need to hire a lot of people now. They need to hire them yesterday. And that's where you come in, Paul?
Well, I think that, yes. What's from hearing these guys talk about things, it's that we were talking about the redlining thing. We were talking about it in the lobby before we came in here. That I think most companies suck at hiring and recruiting. I think they suck at retaining people.
And it's good for you. That's why you have a business.
Well, yes.
Bad for them.
But I think in general, though, it's frustrating because you have companies who are saying that they can't find who they're looking for. And they're not, but they're still just posting their jobs on their career page, and maybe they're running something on Indeed.com. And they're not reaching out to the communities where Lewis is. So you frequently in the technology space, you'll hear companies talking about what we need to hire for, you know, we need to be thinking about diversity and inclusion. Okay, so are we thinking about it? Are we talking about it? Or are we actually going to do something about it? So, for example, here in town, a lot of companies are talking about, you know, we need to have a more diverse workforce. Fair, okay. Technology tends to be a little white. dominated male, that's a pretty fair start, right? So back in October, the National Blacks in Technology Developer Conference came to St. Paul and happened to coincide with Twin Cities Startup Week. And, you know, from talking with my friends who helped put on the conference.
Sharon Kennedy Vickers.
Yep. That the response from the local business community was really good, but not great.
What do you mean?
Well, they could have used more sponsors. They could have used more volunteers.
Oh, as far as supporting the whole idea. Yep. So they'll say on one hand, boy, we need greater diversity, but so let's not do anything about it.
You had 500 plus people of color who are technologists come to your town.
For a headhunter, that's like a feast.
And so for the companies in town, but your dumbass didn't show up to be a sponsor, to be a volunteer, to show off our community, to recruit. So don't tell me you're having a hard time with a labor shortage or a talent shortage. You can't find who you're looking for. It's just you're too lazy to go where they're hanging out. So I was asked a question. There's an event every spring called Mini Bar. Bar not as in like to have a beer, although there are some beers afterwards. Right. It's the bar camp movement that came out of India, you know, 10 plus years ago, where conferences were not so structured. So Mini Bar is an event that's held at Best Buy corporate headquarters every April. Usually 1,300 people sign up, 1,000 show up. It's a big deal. And this one happened to be on the blizzard day. Remember the blizzard back in April?
Oh yeah.
So
sure.
We drove home in that afterwards. 1,000 people still showed up for this tech event. So I do a presentation every year called How to Manage Your IT Career. And I had a gentleman ask me a question from the very top row. It's always the person in the top row who asks the best questions, I think. And he says, essentially he's asking, is there ageism in tech? And I thought I would take a deep breath. Now I'm 48. And so I'm between Lewis and Casey here on the spectrum of age. So I call myself now a middle-aged white guy. And I said, yes, but it's beyond that, though. You have companies who are slow to want to hire someone over the age of 40. They are slow to hire anyone under the age of 25. We do not go where people of color hang out. We have a hard time creating comfortable workplaces for women in technology in many cases. So yes, indeed, there is a talent shortage of white dudes 25 to 35 who will write code for you. The companies who are getting beyond, who are actually wanting to be diverse, who actually want to be inclusive.
The ones that try.
And they're gaining favor, of course. It's there's an old story. Instagram years ago they did a new update on their app, and they couldn't figure out why so many of the photos were being posted upside down. All of their developers were right-handed, and they didn't realize that people who were left-handed took photos a different way, and that's why all the photos were upside down. Just diversity in that simple things, like I want to be around people who do not. I don't want to be around just people who look and act and have experiences like me.
You want ambidextrous people.
Yes. Like, I want to be around people who have experiences and who aren't from here. Like, I haven't ventured far. I grew up in Richfield. I went to the University of Minnesota. I moved back to my parents' house in Richfield. Then I moved to the North Loop. And now I'm living out in the West Burbs. So I'm about as homegrown, haven't gone far. Like, I wasn't in the military.
You gotta join the Army.
I mean, I missed out. And so, but with that, though, we're talking about networks and things. And so my network, though, generally speaking, are people who look like me, right? And so what happens is I find myself at, like, technology events. I'm an hardcore introvert by nature. So we're doing this podcast, and it's just the four of us. This is good for me. But when I get to tech events, I find my, or any event, right? Any business event.
With all those people.
I tend to be against the wall in the corner. I'm observing, I'm watching. But what I try to do is I try to find the people who are also like me. Who is the person in the corner who looks awkward and weird and doesn't know anybody and is looking at their shoes? I will walk up to them and say hello. And that's how we start bridging some of these gaps. Start finding, I did a blog post before Twin City Startup Week. One of the things I begged people like me who have a network in town is don't sit by someone you know, because these events can be like family reunions or the holidays for us. I may not see Casey for a couple of months. I see Casey, I'm going to hang out with Casey. Yet meanwhile, there are two African-American women standing over here to my left, and I don't go over and say hello because I'm familiar with Casey, so I want to catch up with them. How is baby planning and stuff going, right? Meanwhile, there are two women over here to my left who now still don't know anybody, left knowing nobody. If we can start making these simple introductions, if we can start reaching out to people, just stop sitting next to people you know. Stop talking to everybody you know. You can say hi to them, but then go find someone who's on their own. This is the part about then you find and you meet someone like Casey who can be like, hey, you're looking for an entrepreneur. You're looking for an investor. There's a guy named Scott Burns in St. Paul. He runs a startup called Structural, but he's an angel investor. And he almost always, if given a pool of people, and he has spoken about this in the past, he will reach out to those women and people of color before he will reach out to what might be a white man, because he believes that they likely already have some sort of a network from which to start. So if you can reach out to Casey, and then Casey can get you to Scott or any of the other angel investors in town, we can start making these connections and build these networks better.
Boy, it's like there's all kinds of, redlining was traditionally just real estate, right? That you can live here and then we won't give you loans if you live inside this area. So that was part of the catastrophe of North Minneapolis in the first place. It was redlined and no investments. But now in the lobby, in the famous lobby, Lewis, you're talking about different kinds of red lines. I mean, one of them is just social networks, that there's a line that you don't habitually cross traditionally because so many people aren't used to it. But there's also the new red lines in technology.
Sure. And these are not new. They were done with the trade unions and construction. It was, and I'm from a family of merchant marines. So I get it. I was first guy to go to college. So, but if you were one of us, or you were our neighbor, or you married one of our women, or you were a relative, everybody knew how to go down to Union Hall. Once you graduated from high school, you go down to the Union Hall and you get on a boat. And you make short runs at first from Jacksonville to New York, or you'll go around Florida and come into Tampa and then run the Gulf. Once you've done that enough, you go across the pond, right, and go to Europe and Africa and the world. So that was our family thing. And then all these things come out about people. So in order to maintain control, you come up with these rules and things that screen others out. All right. Or you come up with these myths that screen others out. All right. But I tell them, if women can be airborne rangers or jet pilots, they can run a backhoe. Really. And now that we're running drones from Alabama over in Afghanistan, she can beat anybody doing that any day of the week. So it's very hard for people to break patterns. It's hard. But one lesson stood out in my mind, and I've used this in my approach to strategy, which is not politics, but in terms of strategy. I remember as a young lieutenant, they told us that one day wars would be very short, we kill people at very long distances, and we will fight for oil. They told us that in 1992. By 1994, they were rotating us through 14-day stints in the Mojave Desert at the NTC.
I went NTC?
National Training Center. You went out there, you learned to fight at night, you learned not to raise a dust cloud, you learned to bust that ass at 2 miles. It was like, wow, we can do that. Lethality was incredible. But the biggest killer was water, all right, and heat. So you had to, readjust your thinking, right? You had to survive before you could fight. That war was finally fought by the time I got to the University of Minnesota, but we were prepared for it. I argue that businesses who see this about their survivability will win. They will do. Atomic Data, my partner, said, oops, I need labor. I'm growing 30% a year. I can't get it. There it is in North Minneapolis. I need a training partner built in. I will invest money, time, and space. I will build my pipeline. And ta-da, in less than 12 months, he did it. Now we'll offer 5 courses per year, 25 a class. That's the starting point. But you have to be willing to throw the old formula out the door. I was taught to fight by people who came out of Vietnam, all right? It was all jungle tactics. By the time we really went to fight, it was a new war. And now they're running out military operations in urban terrain. It's very different than Vietnam. This is a very different fight. We're used to having this abundance of labor. You treat people like dirt. You know, the boys in the corner get all the perks, and you don't care about them. Cool. No problem. In today's world, since it's driven by technology and the internet, an entrepreneur can sit here and sell to people around the globe. Look at Amazon. You never see the people you're buying from. Is that Sears, JCPenney, Woolworth, Kmart?
I remember those names.
Done.
Distance memories.
Yeah.
Done. And if you don't take a lesson from that, if you don't understand that nobody's ever won in Afghanistan, if you don't take a lesson from those retailers, then we're going to invent a new game to get our people to the people who understand how the game is played. It's an exciting time.
I think that one of the things to think about, too, is one of the things to think about. That was a great line, wasn't it? My grammar. That people, I think that we want to be around. There's an attraction to being around people who are doing new things, and new things require new leaders, too. And so I think that, you know, Casey has an event called Enterprise Rising, and I'll let him speak a little bit more about that. But the idea was that he had the number of non-white dudes who were giving presentations at a technology event was refreshing. And I'll pitch this off to him. But so he's doing a next event then this spring, and he's looking for a couple of sponsors to bring X amount of women entrepreneurs to town and have them take care of the bill and bring these women in from around the country in the Midwest, right? To be able to listen to entrepreneurs and investors and VCs and create these networks for folks. That we have to be active and engaged in creating these networks and crossing over places. Because now, again, you can cross over a line fast now. Like, I don't have to go. I can just go to LinkedIn. I don't have to go to Golden Valley. I'm not going to North Minneapolis. I'm not going to Bloomington. I can just hit a button and create a network. And so we need to start thinking about the ways that people want to work. And I think that during the Great Recession, the employers taught us they will do whatever they have to do to take care of their shareholders and investors. So we can be loyal to our employer, but we better be loyal to ourselves first.
Right.
And we need to take care of our, like I always say, we will fix our car. We will get that oil change. We will patch that roof. We don't take care of the thing that pays for everything until something hits the fan. That's our career.
Well, Casey, how do you find people?
Well, how do I find people? This is a, you are the first person, Steve, to ever ask me this kind of question. I try to collect interesting people, but at the end of the day, I know I'm doing my job right if I'm solving a real pain that people want to participate in, right?
A real pain?
Real pain. So I'm feeling a real void in this world versus just trying to be active and hoping people notice, right? So how do I find people? I'm just of the belief that if you are doing something truly remarkable in this world, and to be clear, I've done many things that are unremarkable, meaning I've had many mistakes, many false starts. I do not claim everything I do is remarkable by any stretch, but that's for other people to gauge. If you're doing something remarkable, people will notice. If you're doing something remarkable, media will notice. If you're doing something remarkable, people will want to roll up their sleeves and say, how can I help? If you're doing something remarkable, then people talk. And so the key to doing something remarkable is to go down a road that it seems like nobody else has the guts to do, or at least not in the way that you think it ought to be done. And what Paul was referring to earlier in his answer about some stuff that I'm trying to do, so I run a conference. It's focused just on entrepreneurship. It's called Enterprise Rising. Happens every spring. I'm having another one in May. And I'm doing something for the first time ever for this upcoming one in May, which is I'm sending 50 female founders.
Well, can you say that real fast? 50 female founders. No, go ahead.
I'm sending 50 female founders to the conference for free.
For free?
Including, so a free two-day pass, which is several hundreds of dollars.
Now, these women are from around the country? Or
maybe from wherever, yes.
Wow. So
it doesn't matter to me where.
So you're seeking them now. You're recruiting.
I'm trying to rip down every barrier I can. And I'm not proclaiming necessarily that everyone needs to do this, right? So, and in addition to the free 2 days to the conference, also two nights at a hotel nearby the venue. So free hotel. So let's say that's $300 value free that they don't have to spend because founders, let's face it, don't have a lot of cash. Free hotel for two nights. That's $400 that they don't have to pay for. So it's just doing whatever I can to make it as frictionless as possible for female founders to attend an event that can really up their game so they can meet amazing people and learn from amazing speakers, but do it in a way where they feel as welcome as possible. And by the way, and I'm excited to do this, and to my knowledge, I'm the first to ever do anything like this in the Midwest, but I should just note that the reason I'm doing it is because when I think about how do I change who gets invited to the dance, there's a quote. It's not my quote, and I don't know who coined it, but the quote goes a little something like this. Diversity is being invited to the dance. Inclusion is being invited to dance. Diversity is being invited to the dance. Inclusion is being invited to dance. And I know that everything I have to say about this topic is probably highly suspect. I have no street cred as a white male. But when I think about my tiny little corner of the universe and what kind of change I can inflict and what things I can influence, which isn't a lot, I'll admit. But if I just focus on what I do control, can I control making female founders who usually go to entrepreneurial events, specifically tech events, and it's like it's a sea of white dudes.
And they look around to see if they can find another woman.
Yeah, I mean, so, mm-hmm. I mean, if I was a female, would I feel like these are my people? Would I feel totally comfortable as soon as I walk into this room? And I'll admit, I never had to struggle with that because as a white guy, I never walk into a room and feel like I don't belong. But what if I was a female? Like, I'll never know what that feels like, but I can try to imagine. And so if I can focus on the levers I control and try to change the ratio, but also make it roll out every red carpet I can imagine by rolling out a program like this, which, by the way, this hurts me financially. This is not in my best interest to do, but and it's a lot of work. But if I can help just 50 female founders feel more comfortable and able to say yes because they don't have to fork out several hundreds of dollars to attend, like, I'm willing to do this all day long.
Hmm. Well, now I wish I was a woman. I could sign up for that. But we'll find out more about that.
Somebody needs to tweet that out.
We need to tweet that out. Okay, Paul, Casey Allen here talking about, sounds like an interesting event coming up this May, looking for 50 female founders that can come here for free. And we're here also here with Major Lewis King. I'll just call him Lewis.
Please do.
And Paul. I'll just call him Paul because I won't try to pronounce your last name. We'll be back right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back, Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau. Our guests are Lewis, Casey, and Paul.
I like that we're all on first name.
We're all on first name, and I'm just Steve. So, it sounds interesting. We're all kind of working on the same thing. I mean, Synapse, it's designed to break down silos of different people, whether it's age, race, occupation, or whatever, and get them to talk to each other. And we found that we'd have these events, and we'd have a great assembly of people, you know, maybe half people of color, and it'd be a good program. And then we'd go on break, and then you'd see the clusters, you know, the white people over here. Black people. It's like, oh, my gosh, what's going on? You know, it's like you said, we had didn't have the inclusion. We didn't, you know. And so then we developed this thing called the Jazz Think Tank, where we systematically talk about the topic, and we're assigned to people that we want four people because that's the ideal conversational group. Everyone has a chance to talk. If it's more than that, some people just ride along. And then setting up a structure, it's got to be at least half people of color, if that's, you know, the demographics we have. And then no one you know. And then we go around, and people are loving it. We're set up to do another one at the University of St. Thomas because they had their little racist incident last spring. So we've been doing them there on a monthly basis.
So, you know, Paul and I, we share something. I hate the cocktail party. But if I get you in a group, a small group, you'll find out, you know, who I am, right? You never know that. I want to take us back to something. And I lean heavily on my experience. The military decided after World War II to desegregate the officer corps because strategically it wouldn't work. They knew in the future black troops would be there, but the commanders need to look like them and be able to command everybody. And they did something that was fairly straightforward that for some reason, it didn't catch on in the business community. It did for a minute, but then it died. IBM, you know, the Control Data, those companies figured it out, but now things are different. They said, never lower standards. Cast a wide net for qualified candidates and build a system, an education system, where everybody goes back to school all the time. So that's the beauty of an apprenticeship, for example. I don't have to worry about what my boy is getting paid, because when he gets so many hours in, he gets a raise. He goes to the union hall to get the classes as an apprentice. Now, the trick is you got to keep him working, which was the beauty of the stadiums and major projects, right? So when those things come along, you can throw a lot of people in the pond, and they're going to get certified as lifeguards. They'll come out on the other end. But the real lesson was you can build a system, which is what we've focused on doing. And with construction, since there are only a few players and big projects, you could latch on to a few companies. This is a bit more challenging. It's more opportunity. You had to go to a construction company to get a construction project done. IT is everywhere. So it's more fragmented, and you don't know where the center of gravity is. There are no Mortensons or Knutsons or Ames, you know, names that you see every day. The only three companies that do all the road construction around here. If you want to do something with MnDOT, you know exactly where Ron Ames is, all right, or Mr. McCrossen. Those are the companies. In IT, there's no center of gravity. So you either have to settle for understanding that universe and learn to fight in it, or you got to create one, all right? If you create one where there's a sheer acute shortage of labor, they will find you. You don't have to find people. You're that thing that they'll gravitate to. So our strategy is to become that thing, all right? And to put into place a system where only qualified, you make them qualified when they're not qualified, like realtors who help you get your credit together, or car dealers who call you on a rainy day and bring you in. You got to build that type of system now to meet the new demand in a highly fragmented environment. So it's challenging, but it's an exciting thing to do. And to meet these two guys, who on one on the labor side and two on the business side, all right, I got the raw product. How do we connect that and create something that doesn't exist?
Now, how long have you been there at Summit?
I led a merger in 1995 between what was TCOIC.
Oh, okay.
Twin Cities. It was in the terminal state. And I had a startup, two or more, that did those big Adirondack chairs around here.
Oh, sure.
That was us. And I led that startup, led that merger, and ran for school board at the same time in 1995.
Got elected. You'll never do that again.
Never. I don't have the temperament for elected life.
Now, I bet some of those...
Hold on a second. That makes you my new best friend. That might be the best line. I don't have the temperament. Yes, then you and I are fine. Yeah.
But I'm wondering if any of those students that went through 20 years ago ever formed a business and are come back and hiring people from you.
Here's where we are. Our strategy all along was to pull up alongside the existing deal and take it over. All right? That was it. If you knew they were going to start to run out of white guys, you can sit there and complain, or you start producing other people. So we started producing people in about 2002. We now have business owners. We have foremen. We have a business agent with the carpenters. Also, the young white guys who were just, you know, the foot soldiers a decade ago, these boys are now running it, okay? We help them get where they are. We're part of their constituency. So the political element of it, we penetrated. And then strategically, when you start looking at people making hiring decisions, or who knows, there's a job here, show up at the trailer tomorrow morning, and here's what you need to do. We've done that. And females as well, and the small companies.
So any people, do you train people to become entrepreneurs?
We do not. We leave that to, so construction is an easy entrepreneur entry and easy exit. Pick up truck and some tools and you're in. First time a job go bad and you didn't have enough money, you're out, right? You know, so bankruptcy's galore. We put them out there and let them go work for someone else and then figure it out. We tried to be, we want fidelity. We don't want that all-in-one printer. We want to be that laser printer, right? We want to be that the best. Well, they don't have stereo systems anymore. We don't want to be the one that's got everything. So we do one thing. We train. And we're the biggest, and we're the best.
Hmm. A few weeks back on our podcast, we had the fellow that's doing artificial intelligence. His name escapes me. Scott Litman. Yeah, he was on. And his theory, his belief is that the coding, and there's a lot of technology jobs that can be automated relatively soon. And so he would advise young people not to major in technology, but to, and then he heard about his friend was, daughter was going to go into acting. He goes, now that's a field that's never going to be replaced by technology, you know, the creative arts. What are your feelings on this? Is it good to keep training people into technology? How long is the window there of the big need for technologists?
Well, so I got like seven answers to that one. The first one is that I think that if you're a technologist or you want to get into technology, you better learn the business side of things, right? So you can be a coder, but you better be able to talk to the CEO, to the CFO, to the business analyst, to the call center person.
The soft skills.
Yep. On the flip side, if you are not a technologist, you should learn to do some coding. It may be because you're creating an email newsletter. It may be to do simple updates to a website. It may make it so that you can your presentations look better. They do more things. But it's also so then you can talk to the developer who's going to be creating the software that you're going to be using at your company. So I think technology is here. It's wise for the non-technologist folks just to dabble, just to learn, just to understand learn how a code works. Might be like a weird way to phrase it, but just understand how it's going to have impact on you. I've been on a rant for nearly a year now that I am frustrated. It's not just at Minneapolis, it's the technology industry in general that says we wanted all these people to go to learn how to code. And unfortunately, a lot of companies are slow to hire junior developers. They want everyone to be a 3 or 5 or 7 year developer.
And another red line.
That's the red line.
And so they won't do it at 3 weeks or 5 months, and then they're shocked, right? So we have this weird funnel. We want to get everybody in, but then we won't give them a job because we need everybody to be experienced. And so I don't know when industry failed to continue to do internships, management training programs.
Apprenticeships
you were speaking of. Like, companies cannot expect that these seasoned people are going to miss. We're sitting in the studio here, and there's a tree across the street. I can't pluck a developer off a tree, right? That's not how this works. They're not plentiful. They are not just out there in the wild where I can go to the street corner and say, hey, are you a developer? Come work with me. Like, we have to train people. And so my frustration is that even if everyone were to go into technology, it still is up to the industry to bring them along. They don't just magically appear underneath a holiday tree, a Christmas tree. They're not wrapped in a nice, neat bow. Here's your 5-year developer with 3 years of backend experience, and they can write some JavaScript code. It's not how it works. So Scott would be right that there are a lot of things that are going to be able to be automated, but with that, though, will also come jobs as well.
Ta-da.
And then, we still need people to be homemade workers and to be construction workers, and we need people to... I think that we have made this technology thing just too big. We have made this like.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, I can't change my oil anymore because my car's a computer.
And so that's the part, though, then. So there is going to be then a need for the Jiffy Lube's not going to go away. Jiffy Lube might go away, but something else may take its place. That's going to be a place where you get your oil changed by someone who is a more advanced worker than the person who just undid the plug 10 years ago. My frustration and my concern is that we need industry, we need employers to understand that when we are bringing out recent grads in any industry after 10 weeks, 30 weeks, 50 weeks, that they need to be brought along and nurtured.
Well, Casey, this
that was a long rant. I'm sorry.
Well, that's fine. We're not timing anybody.
Okay.
I'm
clearly angst up.
The whole idea of innovation, this has been pointed out to me by a number of people, that you have an innovative person that starts a new company, and then it gets big, and then somehow they can't innovate anymore. They need to bring in innovators from the outside, or, you know, people that teach them how to improvise and think. It sounds like a lot of these companies that were started by innovation, they can't think of the next thing now. They have their machinery in place. How do you keep innovation on a constant?
By finding others and bringing them into the fold. So you see bigger companies essentially outsource all their innovation. So Fortune 500.
Like Target and Techstars.
That's right. So if you're Target, you hopefully the CEO has enough self-awareness to know that I probably don't have the right kind of people to really innovate. Innovate big, like in ways that we don't even see the industry coming. Okay. And to innovate, so I don't have the right people. Honestly, I don't probably have the right structure because everything moves slowly in my company because it has to. Because
it goes through one person, makes all the decisions.
Well, it's less about hierarchy and more about culture and DNA. Because once you get to a certain size, it starts becoming self-preservation. Don't screw it up. So the DNA is don't screw it up. And if you're not going to screw it up, you're never going to try. If you don't try, innovation is just a fantasy. So,
like you say about your career, you fail sometimes.
But what works much better, and also what I might admit keeps the flywheel going for innovation and entrepreneurs, is the fact that you can build an amazing company and you can be acquired by Target for $300 million someday because Target needs what you have. They seek what problem you solve and know that they either could never do it on their own or it would take them years and years and years to do it on their own. So they'll just acquire you outright. And it's not just the old stodgy, boring companies I refer to. I'm not just talking brick and mortar retail or financial or medical like UHG, although UHG is very acquisitive too and Optum. But is even companies like Facebook, for example. Facebook bought Instagram. And there's a reason for this is because for a big company, there's only so much innovation that can truly happen between those four walls. And they know that and they understand that. But what do they have? They've got a mountain of cash. And why don't they just deploy it, acquire things that are really doing phenomenal things, maybe even threatening their very business model. So let's acquire them.
Some innovation.
Let's get ahead of it, right? And I wish I saw more of that in Minneapolis. There's no reason why Ameriprise shouldn't have bought Robinhood or Acorn 4 years ago. There's no reason why Ameriprise shouldn't have been, and I say that, it's very easy for me because I'm staring out the window of WCCO's studios right here. I'm staring
at that tree with the
Ameriprise blue and white flag right outside their door. But I mean, there's no reason why they should struggle through all the struggles that they go through with their big financial advisory force and the fact that financial advisors are now retiring and it's difficult to find new up-and-coming financial advisors. But there's so many trends that Ameriprise should have, quite honestly, been ahead of the curve on, and they have largely failed to really innovate. And that's all DNA. That's all culture, for better or for worse.
Well, Lewis, how do you maintain a sense of innovation at your place? I think they call it agility now, to be able to move with the changing world.
So I tell my people, be big, be fast, be first. Okay, and I want it yesterday minute. And when I go into that mode.
That's awesome.
When I go into that mode. No. Okay, so we have a new thing that we're launching. It was birthed on October 28th in Philadelphia as an idea. Within 60 days, we raised several hundred thousand dollars. We had partners, concepts, et cetera, on the table. And, you know, to hear these guys talk from the inside, right, I just look at these things and go, all right, how do I get my people attached? So we said, all right, everybody in all those companies are thinking about the right now. Today, they got to perform right now, and they're going to preserve it. And they're bad as the government when it comes to bureaucracies. So, all right, give them the worker of today. But the worker of today, I will get the adults in. They'll be the vanguard. They'll learn the game. But here come my competitors saying, we can do that, too. No, you can't, but don't worry about it. There's the worker of tomorrow. That kid is in the seventh grade. If you want to go to the United States Military Academy, we have to get you at the seventh grade and get you on track. You don't wake up in the 12th grade and get to meet me in the congressman's office for your interview. Someone had to make you an Eagle Scout, get you a 5.0 GPA. You were the prom king and queen, captain of all the teams.
Four internships.
Yes, sir.
And all those science project winners.
You got it, all right? Somebody had to do that. So, like, now with the rail coming, my eighth graders will graduate just in time to take it to the Golden Triangle out in Eden Prairie. All right? Mm-hmm. That's strategy. And then there's the worker of the future. By the time the CEO is gone and the second one is coming in, or the third one, the four-year-old who we gave a Caterpillar toy, all right, and introduced them to STEM and treated them the same way we treat hockey players in Edina and Wayzata. Mm-hmm. As soon as they can lace them up, you put them on the ice.
They can stand up, give them a puck.
You got it, right? So it's not necessarily about technology. It's about STEM. And then you say STEM Nation, and you make it big, and you put a gaming league in there so the kids can meet with it, right? You had to throw everything off the table and say start over, and then say to your people, I want it done yesterday. Create a sense of urgency. There are people who do nothing but think about tomorrow, and let them drive it home.
I like that. I want it done yesterday. I hadn't heard that before. Maybe you haven't. Boy, I think we've used up our yesterday. We're all done with our program here, but it's
we could keep talking, but we can't.
I'm excited to get a T-shirt made up that says that and give it to Lewis so he can wear it. I want it done yesterday.
I want it done yesterday. So our guests, Major President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC, Lewis King III. Boy, second? Oh, is there a third?
I had three daughters, man.
What? What? Okay, is there a Louisa?
No, that was Louise, my grandmother. As a consolation prize, I got a grandson who was born on my birthday.
Oh,
what?
Yeah,
that's a good one. That's a good one.
Little Chris.
Okay, and we have Casey Allen, who's about to be a father.
Yeah.
Is it going to be a boy or girl?
We're having a daughter.
Good for you.
Indeed.
So she can come to your founder's thing.
Someday, I hope.
Someday.
For sure. This is I certainly have created this conference to well at last me. So that would make...
You could leave a legacy.
Well, I hope everything...
Well, that's what a daughter is.
There we go. So I can two legacies, a two for one.
And then Paul DeBettings, the Minnesota headhunter. I should say the Minnesota headhunter.
See, this is that part of that passive-aggressive Midwest upbringing of mine. I've always blocked it, the. Because there's a bunch of us running around. But then lately I've been kind of trying to embrace a little bit more. Like, maybe I should go with the label.
But you've got the name.
Ah, that's true.
MinHeadHunter.com. So, anyway, thanks for joining us here on Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau. I'd like to thank Dan Culhane, our producer, and mention also this is a co-production with WCCO Radio. Tune in next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.